Songwriters will tell you that they don't always know what they mean. The creative act is as much one of uncovering as it is one of assembling. We uncover what's already there, waiting to be revealed. Some songwriters begin with a poem or a text and fit it to music. For them, the meaning is already there and the music can help to illuminate it. But some start with a melody or a sound, and then they search for the words. For them, there's already meaning in the sound. Andrew Bird describes his process of lyric writing as speaking in tongues, letting the sounds lead first and discovering the meaning later. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Andrew Bird has been discovering meaning in the sounds since he was a young boy growing up outside of Chicago. He learned to play violin using the Suzuki method, starting at the age of 4. And he stayed in Chicagoland for college and got a degree in violin performance from Northwestern University in 1996. Although his college training set him up for a career in music, it also disoriented him. The kid who was at home playing classical and folk, who loved to listen to jazz piano recordings from the 50s, and who wasn't afraid of rock and roll either. Specifically, the sound of recordings made by the legendary jazz engineer Rudy Van Gelder were defining for Andrew. Something about the feeling of those records stayed with him from the very beginning. He made his first album, The Music of Hair, right after he graduated from college. It showcased his singing and his violin skills, and it paid tribute to his fascination with American and European folk traditions, jazz and blues.
I'm just an old dude with a cane made of wood and a dog with a nasal disease. I sit when it's breezing, my dog always sneezing. I swear it's a voice.
That same year, the movie Swingers came out, and jump, jive, and swing music was having a moment all over the country. Bands like LA's Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, San Francisco's Lee Presson and the Nails, and North Carolina Phenom's Squirrel Nut Zippers were making waves. In Chicago, the swing scene was alive and kicking at the Green Mill Cocktail Lounge, where the Mighty Blue Kings held court every week. So it was kind of inevitable that an open-minded musician like Bird, who loved all kinds of music, would end up in that scene. After working with the Squirrel Nut Zippers for a few years in the late 90s, he started Andrew Bird's Bowl of Fire and got busy mining the past in order to find a way forward. The opening track off of their second album, Oh the Grandeur, is called Candy Shop, and although it was recorded in 1999, it sounds like it could be on the B-side of a Slim Gaylord single from 1949.
You let me in your house. You let me in your house. You let me in your house with the ammo.
For Bird, the sound of the Bowl of Fire recordings was as important as the music itself, and he was determined to record in the old-fashioned way, setting up the band in front of only a few vintage microphones and balancing the sound live in the room, trying to blow out the microphones like on those old recordings. And although that diligence appeared to be paying off, he felt increasingly uneasy about being what he calls a lifestyle accoutrement. He didn't necessarily want to play music for swing dancing, but it wasn't clear to him exactly what he did want. The curse of the open-minded, adaptable musician is to be in constant pursuit of something just outside of the frame. So in 2002, Bird left the jump and jive of his Chicago life for the pastoral simplicity of a converted barn in western Illinois and set himself up in a kind of creative isolation and self-imposed austerity. He had no albums to listen to, he had no radio. But he did possess one piece of technology that would end up having an enormous influence on the career that followed. A looping pedal that let him develop densely layered live arrangements totally alone. Soon he reemerged from his barn with a newfound intensity and a new sound that borrowed as much from his classical upbringing as it did from folk music and even indie rock. It was an approach that leaned into space and silence, anticipation and development. He explored the potential of the fiddle and the looper, the gathering hypnotic rhythm of his violin, building one layer at a time, the echo of a thing turning back on itself over and over again. The sound. He began relentlessly performing and documenting, releasing a flurry of studio and live recordings. Then, in that space, he began to sing again, to find a place for his voice.
If you think I'm wasting your time again, I'm wasting your time when you picked me up in duty free, and I thought I'd be the cross in your tea on my CTV.
As his concept evolved, Bird picked up the guitar, the glockenspiel, and started to make use of whistling in his songwriting. And he began speaking in tongues. By the time he released his 2005 album, The Mysterious Production of Eggs, on Ani DiFranco's Righteous Babe label, Bird's transformation from lifestyle accoutrement to conjurer seemed to be complete. And somewhere along the way, it seems, he picked up a thesaurus. Anyone who spent any time parsing an Andrew Bird lyric knows that he is not afraid to use a 50-cent word. Here's Fake Palindromes from that 2005 album.
Mind who we are, Disney brow, waters tribe. Swapping your blood with the mouth of high. Monsters? Whiskey plied, voices cried, fratricide. Jesus, don't you know that you could have died? You should have died. Or with the monsters at all.
As Bird's songwriting developed, the lyrics often became more confessional and more impressionistic. He says he could go back to every song he's written and tell you where it came from personally, but whether or not it's obvious to the listener, that's the question. One gets the sense that he really is letting the sound of the language lead him toward the story he's telling, even if in the end he does know what it means. And the sound he pursued was not just in the words. Around this time, Andrew began recording with the engineer and producer David Boucher, whose own pursuit of evocative sounds would begin to intertwine with Andrew's. Today, much of the sonic landscape associated with an Andrew Bird record can be attributed to Boucher's recording techniques.
There'll be three white horses, all in a line. There'll be three white horses in a line.
So Andrew Bird has been on the journey now for nearly three decades, from virtuosic violin kid to swing monster, to isolated artist in the barn, to genre-defying indie rock folk chamber singer-songwriter with 20 full-length albums, another 10 EPs, and a half a dozen EPs under his belt. He's written music for television and film. He's appeared as an actor on the fourth season of the show Fargo. It's fair to say that Andrew Bird has the kind of career that is harder and harder to come by today. He has an audience that will follow him in whatever direction he chooses to go. He can feed his creative appetites and fill auditoriums. But he's not suffocated by too much success. He calls this the upside of staying obscure. And throughout this journey, it seems there's always been a part of him that has wanted to return to the comfort of the jazz standards and the familiar warmth of those Rudy Van Gelder recordings that he loves. Wouldn't they be so nice to come home to? Earlier this year, he released Sunday Morning Put On, a collection of standards performed by Andrew and his working trio. That's Alan Hampton on bass and Ted Poor on drums. And it was recorded by David Boucher.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire. As a breeze on high, sing a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire.
Sunday Morning Put On is an ode to his favorite recordings from long ago, but it also manages to sound totally like itself. The violin trio format leaves room for Bird's trademark echo to behave as a fourth member of the band, and for every note to matter. Andrew calls the record a sabbatical project because you learn from it, but you're not totally sticking your neck out. After so much confessing, and so much speaking in tongues, and so much living, as he says, his life in song form, the sabbatical also gave him a break from having to squeeze every drop out of his own life and onto the page. This relief, along with a deep musical affection for his friend, the singer-songwriter Madison Cunningham, led Bird to follow his jazz record immediately with another sabbatical project called Cunningham Bird, which he released with little fanfare just this month. It's a recreation of the 1973 album by Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks called Buckingham Nicks.
Well, I got nothing but time. No time for living. I've been everywhere, but it's all the same.
I just need somebody that I can lean on. Nobody wants to keep you when you're in love with the game.
But you know that I can't let go.
We spoke last month, just as he was coming off of his summer tour and confronting what he called the reckoning of returning home. We talked about his early days in Chicago, the journey that led him into isolation, discovering his sound, songwriting as a form of speaking in tongues, what it means to be living his life in song form, and what he learned from singing standards. Third-Story.com is your hub for all things Third Story podcast related. Check out the archive, hundreds of deep dives like this one, and including previous episodes with Andrew's friends and contemporaries like Alan Hampton, Ani DeFranco, Dave Gemmelow, that's the proprietor of the Green Mill in Chicago, and other Chicagoans of diverse distinction like Howard Levy, Amir El-Safar, Sachal Vasandani, Woody Goss, Howard S. Becker, Kurt Elling. Visit leosidran.substack.com for all the most recent episodes and writings about music and life. And you can subscribe there, too. I like it at Substack these days, and I want you to like it, too. And don't forget that we're made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios to find out more about all their award-winning content. Here's me and Andrew Bird talking it down last month.
Hey, Andrew.
Hey.
Thank you for taking time. I know you just came off of the road.
Yeah.
How's it feel to be in normal life?
It's the reentry is a little painful every time, but it's all right.
What is painful about the reentry, man?
Well, it takes about 3 days to get used to being on a bus and playing a show every night, but it takes like 2 months to adjust to being at home and being a normal person.
Do you ever feel like a normal person, Andrew? I mean, it's a little bit of a loaded question, but...
Not really. The only times I kind of feel the way I should is, you know, on a vacation. And then, and that's when I get the most work done, strangely. It's when I'm on vacation, I get so many ideas. But, you know, home life has its own things pulling you in different directions. And touring is very demanding, but very simple. Like, you have a very gratifying job to do at the end of the day, and you got about 5 or 6 hours where you're just kicking around. I just ride my bike every day, and it's pretty sweet, you know. It's like you're gratified and physically and mentally exhausted by the end of the day. You sleep well, you just wake up and repeat.
You basically have one thing that you're aiming for every day. You've got one job to get done by the end of the day.
Yeah, but it is extreme, you know. 4 or 5 nights in a row. By that fourth night, you start to notice like physiological weirdness happening, where instead of like sweating when it's hot, you just sort of get kind of clammy and chilled. And sometimes you just hit a wall and you're like, oh my God, where is it going to come from tonight? And then you have to squeeze it out, gut yourself. That's when you know it's just an extreme way to go. And there'll be a reckoning on the other side of it. I'm used to it, but it doesn't get any easier.
Maybe this is the reckoning. Maybe the return to real life is part of it.
Yeah, that is the reckoning for sure. But it's all good. I'm used to it.
But the other thing is, in general, throughout your career, but I think particularly in this recent tour, you know, you don't make it easy for yourself. You are really naked out there. This particular project is so open and empty and plays as much with silence as it does with sound. There is nowhere for you to hide in this repertoire.
Didn't know what time it was, then I met you.
No.
Oh, what a lovely time it was, how sublime it was too. I didn't know what day it was, you held my hand. Warm like the month of May it was, and I say it was grand.
I mean, I've always, the show's never relied on like hitting the audience hard and them hitting you back. And I watched that dynamic at rock shows with the lights and the band. The music isn't always that great, but it's, you just smack the audience still like, we're back at you. And I always watched that with a little bit of like, well, I suppose I should be doing that, but that never feels right. I prefer the subtle interplay of the musicians and just bring things down to a trio, bass, drums, and violin lately. You know, we were already on this trajectory towards embracing this jazz project, but it's all because all along there's been that sensibility to the live show of listening to each other, responding to each other, playing things differently every night. Whether it's this fairly concise melodic pop song or something more improvisatory.
I was thinking about the trajectory that led you to make this improvisatory jazz record, to take this sort of break in the cycle of original records and do this. You know, on the one hand, it's a departure, and on the other hand, it's such a full circle thing. You know, I went back and I listened to the Bowl of Fire material, and you were knees deep in jazz repertoire and swinging and in speaking that language. Those were your first statements.
Yeah, it's true.
You've got me sitting on your mantle like a little glass figurine. Why must you be so mean? Don't you know I've got better things to do? I'm like a mail order product from a housekeeping magazine. How utterly embarrassing. Well, lady, I'm not going to dance that dance.
It's a bit different, and when I come back to it, that style of playing from my early youth, we tried some of that with this album, and it didn't feel right, the hot jazz stuff. I did a whole couple of days with Larry Goldings just playing stride piano and me playing, but it was too extroverted. Like, for some reason, we wanted to hear something more, way more delicate and understated this time. And yeah, everything that felt too, it took a while to find how I was going to sing on this. Anything that was too from the gut felt too garish and extroverted. So yeah, this is different, but it's true that it's been there from the, I'd say when I was maybe 18 or 19, I sort of discovered, kind of wound my way towards the stuff I really liked. It took me a while from being in music school and getting out the real book and playing Giant Steps when you have no business playing that tune and have no idea what's going on, to then kind of discovering, okay, you know, eventually the entry point was Django and Stephan Grappelli and then Stuff Smith and then Louis Armstrong and then Lester Young and Duke Ellington. And that was the stuff where I was like, okay, this makes sense to me. I understand, like, I really liked how these soloists are trying to create new melodies. You know, they're not just making runs. They're really making like distinct statements with their solos. And that spoke to me more than that really shredding kind of stuff.
Were you primarily a violin player? I mean, were you singing and writing songs, or were you focused originally on playing the violin?
I was pretty focused on violin until I started writing songs when I was 18 or 19, but I would say the turning point was when I was like 26. Up to 26, I was still in student mode. Even though I was putting out albums, I was like, you know, every time I'd walk into a record store, I was like, what can I find? What can I learn from today? What can I absorb and then process and then play? So I was just running around from one style to the next, just soaking it all up, just ravenous for new things. And then at some point around middle 20s, I just said, okay, I'm ready to, I think I got it. I focused more on writing and seeing what my point of view was on all this stuff instead of just sort of soaking it up.
Do you think there was a particular event or headspace transition that had to take place? I mean, it sounds great that you were able to just kind of one day wake up and say, okay, I'm ready, I got it. But I mean, do you think there was a thing? Do you remember a moment or a series of moments where you said,
No, it took a few more years. I mean, I realized that into my late 20s that I was very devoted to the people I was playing with. But then I started to realize that my ear is such that it's so adaptable that I was responding to what the people I was playing with were, what their influences were. I was so used to going into situations and figuring out what the situation wants instead of what I really want from the top down. So it took a few more years and an extreme environment change and a lot of isolation to really make sure I figured out what my point of view was. If I stayed in Chicago and was still playing with people, I'd just keep adapting. I mean, yeah, up until that, a certain age, I was just trying to blow out the microphone, like those old recordings where the singer just had no monitors and he had to sing really loud. And I was trying to sing like Ella Fitzgerald or anyone that you know, with this gigantic voice and personality on stage. And it was a funny scene, yeah. When I started taking it on the road nationally, then it'd be like, I'd show up in Toronto and there'd be like, the promoter would try to get people in and he'd put out a plaque that says, you know, swing dance lessons, Andrew Bird's Bowl of Fire. And it didn't work. It didn't work. Our songs were too stop and start and complicated for that scenario. And it really wasn't, I wasn't content to be a lifestyle accoutrement, you know, with my life's work. So I started to look elsewhere.
My first memory of seeing you and what you were doing was kind of the opposite of that. It was a very solo-oriented, quiet, loopy show. It was when you had discovered how much you could extract out of a solo performance with violin and the loopers. How did you discover that, and what did that unlock for you?
Well, that's when I moved out to this fixed up an old barn in Western Illinois and spent, it was my only address for a while. It was very isolating and I had no albums to listen to. I had no radio and I had this looping pedal that I was learning how to use. It is an amazing tool that I was just thinking, this is amazing compositional, improvisational tool. I can just do this all day long, just keep improvising and stumbling into cool ideas and hearing them, you know, with six layers at a time or more. And it didn't occur to me to do that live because I thought, you know, no one's going to go for this. I was very devoted to like real live acoustic music. But man, it was very liberating on stage too, because there's no one behind me giving me a funny look if I do something on spur of the moment. You know, I would set up kind of the rhythm section and the skeleton of the song and then improvise over that and layer, you know, arco things. And it expanded to then two rigs, for one is pizzicato, one is arco, and it got very elaborate. It was a different kind of performance. It was a little more emotionally draining, and I had to address the audience more because you don't turn inward to the band. You had to really tell stories and like use everything at your disposal to engage people. So I did that for 3 or 4 years. And yeah, it's still something I rarely play the violin without being hooked up to one of those.
I understand how it changed your relationship with the audience. How did it affect the songwriting itself? I mean, if you have to deliver a song that essentially you're building in front of people, it limits certain turns that you can take. So what happened? How did that change?
Well, the first song that I figured out how to do it was this song called Why, which is very much could fit on this jazz album very easily. It's a 32 bar ballad, AABA.
Why'd you do that? You shouldn't have done that. If I told you once, I told you three times, that you'll get your punishment when you show me your crumbs, and it's not.
With the looper, you can only do a verse, or you can do the bridge, or verse and chorus. There were three chords in the verses, so I could handle that. And so then I would play the verses as a loop. And you think a loop has to be in time, but with this particular song, I would play jump, dun, dun, dun.
Why'd you do that?
And then I'd wait until I was so far back on the beat that I was three beats back. But somehow it worked, even though it was coming around every 12 seconds, you'd get the same out of time thing. But it worked with the lyrics, it worked with the theatricality of the delivery. And then I would play the bridge, I'd play tremolo, turn off the loop. And compared to the album version, it became such more of a, I don't know, that song still to this day, I do it and it cracks me open. It's so free, and there's so little that it's explicit about it, you know, that's been blueprinted. It's the bare minimum amount of information. That was kind of an eye-opener that I could make that work, but it took a lot of charisma and theatricality to make it work as well.
Right, so some of it was music and some of it was performance. Like you had to fill in the spaces personally somehow.
Yeah, no, the story I tell, I was playing a solo show in Mallorca, of all places. And after I played that song, after that show, this woman comes over to me, tall, older woman, smoking a cigarette, and she says, "You are like a clown." And I was like, okay, we're in Europe, so I assume you mean like the more, you know, artistic sort of clown, not, you know, not the American clown.
Yeah.
But her point was that it was very theatrical.
Yeah.
And yeah, to this day, like sometimes when I overwrite a song, I can't do that. You know, it's all about just delivering the pieces of the song, and those have the shorter shelf life than songs like that one that I wrote 20 years ago.
Yeah, and maybe also, like, you know, one of the things that clearly developed in the sound of all your records, including the jazz record Sunday Morning Put On, is that you found a way to embrace space. And also, I mean, it's not a trivial thing. The echo and the reverb and the ambient environment that you place yourself in is so much a part of the personality. And I imagine that some of that was born at the time when you were alone looping yourself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, with this album was made in a very small room at Valentine Studios. The room didn't want to hear too many instruments or too much volume. And so we were just kind of adapting to that space. But I really love, and I've always loved these small group, very understated albums from the 50s, mostly the 50s. Piano trios, Vince Guaraldi, Wynton Kelly, Red Garland, you know. A lot of these piano trios, really, where there's just there's a lot of space, a lot of mood. It's nothing that's gonna set the world on fire. It's just so tasteful, and that's sort of what I wanted to do. I mean, I've been listening to this music my whole life, or most of it, and it's been a baseline for me all these years underneath whatever I'm doing. I just thought, you know, I think I have a point of view on this now that's worth listening to. But as far as the sound of the album, I do have a very some strong opinions. Like when we made the Bowl of Fire stuff, it was in New Orleans. It was a one or two RCA 44 mics. We had the bass player out standing on a coffee table to get his F-holes up near the mic. I mean, we were pretty religious about that, but for different reasons than today. I think that was like a little more like, we're going to go for that sound of that time. This time it's more like, I'm not interested in doing a vintage retro thing. I just feel like, you know, the problem with a lot of albums today is there's just too many microphones and too many bits, too, you know, 196K with cymbal crashes is extremely fatiguing to the brain to hear at that high resolution. There's just too many inputs and too much information coming, and it just wears you out. I wonder, an experiment interesting to make would, you know, say Coltrane's My Favorite Things or something. Would that recording be so timeless if it was recorded today at 196K in a modern studio with tons of mics on the band and isolation? Maybe, because the ideas are there, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to maybe part of the question is just like the psychoacoustics of recordings, right? Like, it's not just the ideas that we're hearing. We're not just hearing the notes. We're hearing the way they interact, the way they make us feel. And I've never heard anybody say that it's such an interesting idea that the resolution is almost too hyper-real for us to really have that emotional response to today. Because I would imagine, like, the question is My Favorite Things recorded in 1987 on early digital with Lexicon reverb and DI bass sound, would we still want to hear that today?
It probably wouldn't be as timeless. I mean, when I hear those albums, I'm struck by not how vintage they sound, but how real and in the room they are, how just good they sound. I feel like that hi-fi era from like 58 to 64, 65, whatever, is really, really exceptionally great sounding stuff. And so, you know, the Rudy Van Gelder stuff, the bleed between the mics and the instruments and you know, the embracing the room and what the space you're in instead of trying to affect it all in post. I mean, just, I don't know, just most modern recordings just sound so contrived because once the performance is over, it's just a lot of plugins and effectings of the tracks. And I it's just what makes recordings stand the test of time and remain heavy and affecting are the flaws and the sense of realness to me.
But I can see that you are manipulating sound. You're just doing it in real time. Like, I saw some live footage of you doing these tunes, and I can see that you're drenching often the violin in reverb. I think In fact, when I hear you in general, I'm really struck by how much sustain you get out of the pits sound. I know other violin players, when I hear their pit sound, it's like it's a much shorter, smaller decay. You get a lot of sustain out of it. Like, you know, it really does cover the same ground that a guitar would cover. I'm sure a lot of it's in your fingers and your technique, but it does seem like you're also able to lean into the echo to get a lot of that sustain out of it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is like, it's the violin, but a lot of it over these, it's like, it's the amp, and I've got an original deluxe reverb, and the reverb just sounds amazing. Generally, I'm a little suspicious of reverb as like a thing that, you know, kind of levels everything or puts an anonymity to it. But for the violin, it needs a little help because it's so strident, and it needs a little more sustain. How I position my amp and the vocal mic and the bleed between the vocal mic and the amp across the room is something that, you know, so it's trial and error. We did a lot of trial and error just before we recorded with the vocal, getting it to get that sibilant lip smacking intimacy that reaches out of the speakers into the room.
Long ago, my heart and mind got together and designed the wonderful girl for me. Oh, what a fantasy. Though the ideal of my heart can't be ordered a la carte, I wonder if she will be always a fantasy. Will I ever find the girl in my one who is my ideal?
So yeah, but once the tape's rolling, it's about the performance. The production is, everything is pre-production, that goes.
You're so much a wordsmith and songwriter, and I can tell that you spend time thinking about what you have to say when you write songs. What is it like for you when you go into a project where it's not your lyrics? What's your relationship with these lyrics like?
You know, it's, in choosing the songs, there were some that songs that I really wanted to do because they were just iconic, classic, like Stardust.
That you did do, or that you did that you ended up not doing?
We didn't do, but I think I cut them because the lyrics didn't quite measure up. You know, that these Broadway show tunes that became jazz standards. A lot of it is the sophistication of the writing and the sort of erudite, you know, urban sophistication of these Cole Porter and also the heartfelt sentiments. It's just sometimes they can be a little fluffy, and sometimes they really lyrically really cut to the chase. And I definitely, yeah, Body and Soul was the other one I wanted to do, but I was like, yeah, these lyrics don't quite, not the Caravan is the greatest. Those are written after the song was written, you know, just to fit the melody.
But of Caravan, that melody is so evocative that it's kind of like, it's cool. The lyrics are cool because they fit the melody.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a sort of cinematic image that fits the melody.
Night and the stars above that shine so bright. The mystery of that fading light as shines upon our caravan.
And I've been doing that song since I was 19. And doing it in dive bars and rock clubs all through my 20s, and it's always rocked, you know, just delivered in that context, like high energy, fun song. So I wanted to finally get something of that down.
Do you think engaging with these songs for so long now, crawling inside the skin of these songs for the last year, do you think will have some impact or influence on you for better or for worse when you sit down to write a new batch of original songs?
Yeah, the thing I got to be careful, I'm already writing the next batch of original songs, is not to overwrite them. And that's what this stuff reminds me to do. Like, I Fall in Love Too Easily with 16 bars of perfection, and that's all you need, you know? It's two stanzas of lyrics.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love
too terribly hard for love to ever last.
We've been doing that one every night at the top of the set in our outdoor amphitheater shows, and people get it, you know, they like it. So yeah, in that sense, and then going, we've been doing that. We've been starting the set with a couple of these tunes, and then I do Why, and then I do Bloodless, and all the tunes that kind of fit with this jazz to soul jazz kind of vibe, and then it kind of segues out into the stuff I'm maybe more known for, and it creates a nice dynamic set. You know, we started doing these shows with Ted and Alan, and right away we started realizing, like, this is taking on a different feel. I'm kind of bowing in between vocal phrases, or pits in between, but mostly the bowing, and then kind of singing what I'm bowing. You know, because it's in jazz, there's not many people that play linear melodic instruments that also sing immediately after a solo or before or during a solo. You know what I mean? It's hard to think.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about what, for example, what Chet would have to do, he would sing and then he would play, but he wouldn't sing a phrase, I don't think, then put the trumpet in his mouth, comment on the phrase that he just sang.
After one of these shows, like, Ted was like, you know what, this is starting to take on like a Jimi Hendrix experience kind of feeling, which is also like very jazz adjacent.
You know, when you were talking about writing or engaging with these kind of simple jewel box lyrics, you know, that are not, I don't want to say that you are overwriting other lyrics, but you take a lyric like Sisyphus, that's a lyric that is, you know, is a very dense lyric, and it has a lot of this internal rhyme and these sounds that are kind of like, so much of the meaning to me in that lyric is coming from the sound of it, the repetition of these vowel sounds and the way they're rolling on top of each other.
Yeah.
And that's not how the standards are written.
Sisyphus peered into the mist, the stones stole from the precipice, Paul.
Yeah, some of my songs are recited kind of spoken song. Like that one.
Did he jump or did he fall as he gazed into the maw of the morning mist? Did he raise both fists and say to hell with this and jazz? Let the rock roll.
And are about kind of the rhythmic play, and some are sculpted to the melody. Yeah, the ones that are rhythmic and spoken song take on a whole different feel. It's kind of like a proselytizing feel to it. Yeah.
Do you find when you're writing lyrics like that, or when lyrics like that reveal themselves to you, that you are letting sound lead the process? Are you trying to say something, or are you letting the sound say it and then kind of backing into what is this? What have I just said?
Yeah, I do think it starts that way, but then there's an editing process where you're like, I got to rein it in and make some sense here. If you can get 60% of the song written just on sort of stream of consciousness, speaking in tongues, but the subconscious ideas that you're thinking about, you know, it's like that flow starts happening of words, and they just kind of point it at the subject matter that you just keep reminding yourself, oh, I'm trying to say this, and you keep pointing it at this melody too that you're working on, and it's trying to get them all to stick together. That's the way I start the process for speaking in tongues, and then it all starts to make sense because of what I am concerned about at the moment and heavy editing.
Do you agonize over that process? Do you let it take the amount of time that it needs to take? I know sometimes you have instrumental songs that take years before words are visited on them.
Yeah, it takes forever to do it that way, to just wait for things to align and come out of the ether. And there's a period right now that I'm in with writing where the ideas are still going off and sleeping with other ideas and not monogamous yet. You know, they're checking each other out and seeing if they fit together. And, oh, because it came out of me in a certain period of time, then you find that there's themes and threads. Yeah, but when you start with a really strong melody and you have nothing you know you want to say yet, that's an agonizing process.
Especially because those melodies are filled with so much potential and you probably want to do right by them. You know, you don't want to let
them. No, it's like, I was like, could this just be an instrumental? To really make it compelling, it's got to have the human voice delivering it, and that's what drives me to eventually write the lyrics.
You're dealing with three instruments that are extremely evocative in their own way and kind of relate to one another. You have the violin, you have your voice, and then you have whistling also, which is another one that is filled with all this, I don't know, it's so evocative and so unusual, and you can get a lot of information across just by whistling sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I think people respond to that because it is so casual. Mm. Violin is so difficult and inaccessible to anybody. It's like most people can whistle. And the fact that you whistle when you're doing the dishes or whatever, and then to put that on a stage makes somehow kind of relatable and yet unusual to people. It's all coming from the same place. I mean, a lot of times I can whistle ideas, more sophisticated ideas, than I can play right away. But that was part of what this process was, to reconnect my improvisation with the violin again. Not that it was far off, but it's like, you got to get it in your bones and get it in your fingers. And when you're whistling, it's just like, oh, I could listen to jazz all morning, and then for the rest of the day, I'm just whistling possible solos. But I can't walk around all day with a violin playing possible solos. I mean, I can't, but yeah, you know. So, yeah, I mean, a big thing I wanted to get with this album was, there's, since I stopped playing classical music, you know, when I was 19 or 20, in the last 20, 30 years, my playing has evolved around the songwriting, but also along from improvising, and just my technique is just sort of naturally gravitated towards what I need to do, which is not to play Dvorak by Lincolnshire, it was to play whatever I'm doing for my song. So there's a certain like fluidity to the way I bow that I think is kind of, I've come to realize, is a lot more like a reed player. And the reed is a little closer to the human voice too. So the way when I'm singing and I'm playing, whistling, there's just this linear stream of melodic ideas that could come out through any of those. But I really wanted to reconnect with the violin and the tone, and the, you know, I'm listening to Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, that sort of fluid, languorous style of playing. That's like one of my favorite things in music, is that sound. So I wanted to try to capture that.
These songs have often been used as vehicles for harmonic exploration. Often the way people will take a standard and adjust it is to revisit the harmony, to reharmonize it, to find a way to play dense harmony inside of it, whatever. Because of your trio, there's just not as much opportunity for that. It's much more about looking at it, I think, melodically, because you just don't have that much density that you can work with on the violin. And I think in a way, that's why it doesn't play like a normal standards record. It doesn't feel like a jazz record that, even though I understand that you're thinking about Rudy Van Gelder and Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young and Chet Baker and all that stuff, and maybe it is more evocative of that kind of older stuff, but it doesn't feel like a quote unquote modern jazz record in the way I think a lot of other people would be approaching this. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it's drums and two fretless instruments with very little chording, and the fact that they're both fretless is also like really hard to like keep in. It's like trying to sing a cappella and not get off from the root. Harmonic stuff, like, I only play what I hear in my head. If I'm not hearing dense Bill Evans chords in my head, then I don't really play it. I mean, I was pushing myself, I was listening to a lot of that classic solo of Coleman Hawkins playing Body and Soul, and I was like, oh, this is so brilliant. Can I really figure what he's doing with these chromatic things? And that was me. I don't think that way. I don't think in terms of theory. I just, like, if I hear it in my head, then it's good. But if I push beyond what I hear in my head, then it sounds contrived. Maybe I'm just not, I like dissonance, but I only go as far as I can go. Like I said, I've always loved a great solo where the soloist is playing a new simple melody, and it doesn't have to be obtuse, or, you know, it was interesting. Like, yeah, I kind of follow the branch of the jazz tree that goes through Kansas City to New York, but I follow like where Charlie Parker and like Coleman Hawkins sort of split off a little bit, or Don Byas is another good example. You hear glimpses of bebop, or what we think we know bebop is, harmonically, but, you know, like one of my favorite recordings is Don Byas playing with Slam Stewart, like, solo at a jazz philharmonic, and Slam Stewart is just still kind of swing, jive, jump, whatever. It's not that out there. It's pretty accessible and entertaining. Mm-hmm. if I could play like that someday, I'd love to keep trying.
No, I mean, it's very interesting. And also, I think you're approaching this stuff from the point of view of songs also. First of all, you are also a singer, but you're also a songwriter. Yeah. And so, you know, you're playing these songs, you're delivering songs, and you're also delivering them to an audience who, you know, it's possible and maybe even likely that your audience, this sort of, if there is such a thing as an average Andrew Bird fan, may not know these tunes or know any of this reference that you're talking about. Might not have ever heard a Lester Young record or a Rudy Van Gelder recording or whatever.
What happened when we were making this album is I certainly didn't expect it to be, we came in thoroughly expecting to make an instrumental jazz album. And
really?
Then the pull of wanting to bring the voice into it, and once you bring the voice into it, you want to serve that and you want to make it more concise and less exploratory in some ways. Something in my own way I make my own records kicked in.
Yeah.
There was a gravitational pull towards just like getting these songs generally under 4 minutes and like delivering it like I would my own song.
I don't experience this record that differently from your other records. I mean, I think it lives pretty nicely in the collection. Do you think your audience, like just performing this, if you just played Hollywood Bowl, you played big outdoor venues, I mean, did you feel a difference in the response from the audience?
I could hear people vocally responding in the middle of a solo or in the improvisational stuff, like appreciating that when we were playing these tunes. So that was encouraging. I don't feel like I was trying anyone's patience who wants to hear like the Sisyphus or whatever. One of the nice things about my audience is that they've come with me along with me on this, everything I've done, and they're not calling out for the hits. It's the upside of being somewhat obscure for a long time. They were really, really receptive, and it worked. First, Ted was saying, I don't know if this is going to be a live thing, and I can't picture us playing, you know, jazz festivals, and yet we might do some of that. And I certainly didn't expect much from mainstream jazz world acceptance from that. But so far, people have been pretty into it.
You know, Alan Hampton is a friend, and I spoke to him the other day and was remembering when he started playing with you. And, you know, and he said to me, you know, it's funny. I mean, part of the thing was that I was trying to get out of the jazz world, and I was really excited about, you know, not just playing all these jazz gigs. And here I find myself 10 years later touring this jazz record with Bird. You know, I don't think he sounded like he was disappointed about it. It was just kind of a funny turn of events the way that happened.
Yeah. And I've got him playing bass solos now, which is something he would make fun of all those years. There's a lot of talk backstage and when we're on the road about the sort of jazz jock world that they came from and how much they are happy to be out of it for a while anyway. But I'm playing with these great jazz players, and I just, that's part of it, was Ted and Alan. And I've always felt like every time there's some sort of X factor in a set, it heightens everything else in the set. You just got to have something that you weren't planning to do, and it makes everything, it snaps everything out of muscle memory.
I have heard that you're moving from this project into another set of material that is also not original, that you've started to work with Madison Cunningham on a new project. Can we talk about that one?
Yeah, I've been wanting to do some project with Madison for a while because I think she's one of the most talented musicians I've ever encountered. And we've done a bunch of tunes together and toured together. But
it was
in your band
a few years ago, right?
Yeah, it was. She was playing guitar and singing, and that was a dream. We decided to cover the Buckingham Nicks 73 debut album, working with Mike Viola.
She was that kind of lady, and times were hard.
She come curling around you like finger,
and she'll leave you crying in the night.
She will leave you crying in the night.
She's gonna leave you crying in the night.
She's begging
time, looking around.
We just started working on it, just recording it, whether we knew we were gonna be able to put it out or not. Just, you know, it didn't really matter what the source material was. To do just a project of recording with Madison was just a constant flow of cool ideas, and it was, it almost had my head spinning how many ideas were flying around. But yeah, we did our own kind of take on the whole album, top to bottom. It's funny that there's a crossover, one tune that's on both those albums, which is Django, Sunday Morning Put On. And then Lindsey Buckingham, in the middle of the album, just drops that guitar instrumental version of Django.
What does this say about where you are, though, in your career, mid-career moment of pause of doing these? I mean, you did actually this Vince Guaraldi thing first and Hark, and then Sunday Morning Put On. You follow that up now with this. Like, are you sort of just desiring a little? I know you're writing incestuous songs right now. They have yet to play, as you say, monogamously with each other. But are you wanting to take a break from writing?
No, it's more like I know when I start writing those new tunes that it's going to lead to an album campaign. It's going to lead to a touring cycle. And I've done like 15 of those. And like, I just don't see why we can't just put out albums for the sake of, you know, making music. And, you know, we're in an era where, like, years ago, they were like, oh, you got to stop turning out albums every 2-3 years, it's too much. And now it's like a little more, for a while, then recently it's been like more is more. Like, I don't know what the industry cycle is so annoying. I just want to keep, you know, active and vital as a musician. So whether that's to lounge stuff or doing these sort of sabbatical, I call them like sabbatical projects. Yeah, they're like, you're learning, you're pushing yourself, but you're not totally sticking your neck out. And these are songs of my whole existence.
You have gone out of your way, it seems like, to be like extremely prolific, creative about the way you release stuff. You release a lot of material. You release live material. You release sort of companion albums. Like, a project isn't just a project for you. It sets off a whole cycle, which I hear you saying you're tired of. But I also get the sense that that's been your MO for the longest time, is keep putting it out, keep putting it in front of people.
Yeah. No, I just mean what was demanded of the, you know, the singer songwriter thing that started with Dylan and Joni Mitchell, of like, you're supposed to have lived every moment of everything you're singing, and it's a different thing. It's a different than these other projects. You know, they're challenging, but they take the pressure off that expectation that it's your life being presented in song form.
Are you presenting your life in song form?
Increasingly, yes. As the albums progress, yeah. I mean, I think up until, like, you know, Noble Beasts, and it was sort of a transitional period of like becoming more confessional and inserting more of my own experiences in there. I mean, all this, I can go back to every song I've written and tell you where it came from personally, but whether it's obvious to the listener or not is the question. That's a fair question, but yes, it takes a whole nother level of writing these songs and then recording them, putting them out. And it's way more intense than these last two projects.
It reminds me of something I was thinking about talking to you about briefly anyway, and I feel like there may be some sort of a tie. I mean, they could be totally different experiences, but I know that you know, you've done a little bit of acting too. And I imagine that, you know, when you're acting, you're not really you. You're saying somebody else's lines. You're playing a role that isn't you. The combination of hearing you describe what you went through when you started playing solo on, you know, solo looping with the violin, where it was like you had to fill the space personally. You had to find a character almost of your version of yourself to play. What was it like when you started acting? Was it uncomfortable? Was it oddly familiar? Was it?
It took a minute and a lot of fretting to figure it out, because I kept trying to relate it to what I do and it didn't quite translate, because when I'm on stage, I relate it more to being like a comedian. You don't really have much, like those solo shows, like you got
the mic and a little shrug of the shoulders, you know, like, I don't know if this is going to work, folks, kind of thing.
Clown.
You're like a clown. When you're acting, it's like you're pretending to feel things you're not necessarily feeling. And that's the challenge, is to like, and then to do it like multiple times in a row. But by the end of it, I thought, I've only done it really once with the Fargo thing, but it was, I was like, okay, I got this. Put me in, coach. And then it was over.
You say, you know, you're pretending to feel things that you're not really feeling. And I think that in a way that sort of ties into this thing about songwriting, where some songwriters will absolutely create feelings, emotions, stories that they have not personally experienced. And others really do kind of need to dig into their own personal well or draw from their own well. It sounds like you're the latter.
Yeah. I've done a few things where I've like, you know, where you get commissioned to write something and I'm like, I'm a professional, I can do this. And whether it's for a TV show or whatever, and I can crank it out. Like, I'm like, pretty quickly, half an hour, I could give you a song. Whether that, you know, then the real test is if I like, okay, so they didn't take it, or I said it was too good and I didn't give it to them, and I try it on stage. The real test is like, if it's not genuine, I break into a cold sweat. I'm like, when can this song be over? You know, if it's not coming from a genuine place.
Yeah.
But there's other times where I like do stuff on commission for, yeah, I like do some film score stuff or like, or they say, write me a song about this. And I'm like, I can do it and I enjoy it. But if I really go give it my full self, then I don't want to give it to them. You know, it's like handing them a body part, you know.
You said one other thing earlier today that I wanted to circle back on, which is this idea of kind of not being too famous. You know, this idea that I look at your career and I think, what a wonderful career where you have all this creative flexibility. You're able to explore and experiment. There's always risk, but you're not dealing with the demands of a business that expect an overly specific thing from you. You're allowed to move around. How do you feel about where you are in your career? Are you satisfied with your career? Do you feel understood? Do you feel rewarded by what's happening? Are you frustrated?
I get frustrated sometimes, but I'm mostly pretty satisfied and usually dealing with a little more than I can handle. Anyway, so I'm usually wanting to retreat. But I mean, I've done the last 3 summers playing amphitheaters and to pretty full houses. And I feel really lucky to pull that off, like to be mountain biking every day and playing music and filling amphitheaters and making a living. So like, honestly, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. And what I was saying about like the audience comes along with me on whatever whimsy that I want to follow. I feel very lucky about that I've designed something that I don't ever have to feel trapped by what I've created, you know, or that I've got to phone it in, or that I've got to put the in-ears in and put all the amps off stage. And, you know, everything is so hosed in, like still being able to play into an old one microphone on stage, just pretty much play anything we're feeling that day. And I feel pretty lucky to do that.
Did you see anybody who had a career like that, that you thought, that's who I want to be? I feel like you kind of invented it.
I did not see it. No, I see when I go to shows, I can tell when someone's trapped by what they've created, and I break into a cold sweat in the audience out of empathy, because I know what that feels like. You know, I've done it myself and I really try hard to avoid it. Yeah. I'm pretty happy. There's times when I'm like,
yeah,
when I get told no, that I can't do that, or that you're not wanted here or something, that's no fun. But mostly it's like, it's all I can handle, what's coming at me and opportunities. And they're always different and kind of exercising different parts of me. So that's, you know, every time I do a project, it's pretty much why I do these just jazz album and the Buckingham Nicks, is like what my own songs demanded me in that whole industry cycle. Once that's over, like there are parts of me that may have atrophied in order to present this concise material statement of who I am or what I think. So you need to, in order to keep moving forward, you need to get outside yourself and play other people's songs and through your take on it. And That's essential to the free-flowing process.
While we're talking, the final thing I want to talk to you about is just Chicago. I just want to know if you feel that your relationship with Chicago or your development was a byproduct of being in Chicago. What Chicago means to you today now that you don't live in Chicago, just looking back.
And so every time I go back there, I'm in a retrospective mood, especially this time I played the Green Mill in May. This is my old neighborhood. And it's just the opportunity to be so immersed and pay such cheap rent and be exposed to so much. I mean, yeah, the story is I would stay up all night listening to jazz, Blues Before Sunrise radio station on WBEZ, and then Dick Buckley's show on Sunday morning. And then I'd go to the Green Mill in the afternoon or in the morning and listen to the jukebox. And I'd be playing clubs, you know, 3 or 4 nights a week. I mean, there's not many places where you can do that except New Orleans and Austin and maybe New York. But it wasn't a place where you were had to hustle so hard, and you were pretty well supported by the music community, and no one's there to get super famous. So it was a place that I could easily develop. It was crucial.
On the other hand, do you think you could have stayed there and had the career that you have today?
I could have. I was just, frankly, just depressed there, like the winters and the darkness, and that was dragging me down. And someplace that's so familiar to you, and then to get fairly well known in that place that you've been for so long could be extra alienating. So I was just feeling all that when I had to get out. And I was there until I was 36. It was a good run. But what an amazing place it was.
Andrew Bird, thank you for taking time to talk today. It's really such a treat to talk to you. And
yeah, and you. Good
talking
to you.
There he was, my friends, Andrew Bird, living life in song form. Great talk, thoughtful guy, incredible artist. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.